This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the show, Harriet Williamson, and Jason Croft is at the controls for this hour of the show. We're happy to have back again on the program Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has practice in her area, the Women's Health Practice in Champaign. And for a long time, she's been a regular feature of the show. She's now on the program every other month. It's always on a Monday. And we talk about women's health. So this is your opportunity to ask questions. She always comes prepared to talk about a few things that are new and that are in the news. And of course, there's always health in the news. But also, she's here to answer questions. And whenever we have physicians on the program, I do try to always say right up front, you realize there are limits as to what we can do here over the telephone. We can't do diagnosis over the telephone. But, see, and then also the next thing I say, I don't want to discourage people from calling, having said that. If you have questions, this is a good place to get some basic information. And I know that the doctor will, she'll give the best answer that she can, given that she can't see you. So all questions are certainly welcome, and she will take her best shot at them. Give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We also have emails, and you can do that, too, by emailing us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much for being here once again.
Thank you. Good morning.
So what do you want to talk about here?
I have a few new things to talk about. There was a study that was just released from a Kaiser organization in California that interestingly looked at what happens to all these women who stopped their hormone therapy in about 5 to 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And they found an interesting increased rate of hip fractures. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about that. We always like to talk about ovarian cancer protection and other things that we can do positively with our diet. So there were a couple of kinds of nutritional things that I thought I'd talk about post-turkey here. And one is how eating soy can actually be somewhat protective against ovarian cancer. And I also thought about talking about the newest study on vitamins in pregnancy. So I know we've talked a lot about vitamin supplementation. There's been a lot in the news about how vitamin supplementation maybe isn't the health benefit we always sort of attributed to it. Mm-hmm. There's some interesting new news for fertility patients in the use of the hormone estrogen and actually how we can best prepare our uterus to become pregnant. So for those people where their 2012 resolution is to have a baby, we have a couple of things about that. In medicine, we've always in the past done a lot of overall treatment of patient groups so that we prevent those people that are at risk for a disease from getting that disease. So for instance, all of us are supposed to eat less so that our cholesterol is down, but some of us just naturally will always have low cholesterol, no matter how much fat you intake. And so that's a little bit debatable. And in many areas of medicine, we do some over-treatment. And it turns out to prevent Rh disease in pregnancy, we probably over-treat about 40% of people that don't necessarily need to be treated. So there are some advances in how we can maybe look beyond what an ultrasound can look at and try to figure out not just say what the sex of your baby is, but what actual blood type your baby has so that maybe some moms who are Rh negative could actually avoid Rogam treatment. And I thought if we still have time, I might touch upon the new pap smear guidelines, but they're in such a muddle again, like the mammography. We were living in the shining day where all organizations were recommending the same thing for pap smears, and now some of the organizations are becoming a little bit split in their guidelines. And so your gynecologist and your family practitioners and your internists and one organization versus another organization might start giving you some different messages about what type of pap smear and how often to have a pap smear. So I thought I'd start to touch on that, but maybe in the next couple of shows get more into that. Hopefully some of these organizations will get together again, because like mammography, years ago, we used to sit here and people asked us a mammography question. We used to be in a muddle just to know which expert to quote.
Okay. Well,
so we have quite a bit. I have more.
And I do actually have an email from somebody.
Sure, let's start with that.
So maybe you will want to do that. And this is someone who writes in that a friend mentioned a mutual acquaintance who was in the hospital. And when I asked why, I realized with the first word, I knew this woman's reproductive history. All my friend had to say was fibroid. She didn't have to get as far as tumor or uterine for me to know that the acquaintance, who I didn't know well enough, what car she drives, had multiple pregnancies in her early 20s, tubal ligation in her late 20s, endometriosis and or fibroid tumors and or menstrual periods so heavy they would be considered hemorrhagic, hysterectomy, and medical menopause by her 40s. She goes on to write, I've seen this with woman after woman over the past 50 years, and still women are told that tubal ligation is as safe as a vasectomy. So the question is, the person who is writing is, why aren't women told the truth about the after effects of tubal ligation and the real chances of dire outcomes with happening within the following 15 or 20 years?
So the CREST study studied long-term outcomes of tubal ligation specifically, and we also have new procedures for female sterilization that are more like the vasectomy. So I want to address both of those. So there's no medical evidence that that litany of complaints that you proposed that this patient has are linked to tubal ligations. So that most studies do not show any increased risk of endometriosis, uterine fibroids, pelvic pain, but that tubal ligations indeed do not treat any uterine conditions. So that patients who were on treatments for those conditions, i.e. birth control pills, it is possible that when you discontinue that treatment that you're going to have some gynecologic side effects. So if somebody was on birth control pills for contraception plus irregular bleeding, now she has a sterilization, she's going to have potentially a resumption of that irregular bleeding, because now that she's sterilized, she's likely going to stop her treatment of that irregular bleeding that also happened to be her contraception. And the CREST study specifically, and it's capital C, capital R, capital E, capital S, capital T, and I believe it was sponsored by the National Institute of Health, at least in part. But there's a lot of good information online about that study and specifically looking at long-term risks of various gynecologic disorders, and they did not find that. Now, tubal ligations are not 100% effective. We found by the CREST study that perhaps failure rates over time, if you look instead of down the line 1 year, 2 years, but if you look down the line 5 years, 10 years, we find a slightly increased rate of failures versus what we had before. So, but that's a consequence of the method, and nobody was ever told that the method was going to be 100%. We do have now these essentially about as non-surgical as you can get, but we don't have to any longer necessarily make cuts in a woman's abdomen and do that sterilization procedure through a surgical procedure, but we can go transcervically, so in other words, through the cervix, and put either a non-metal implant or a small metal coil in the corners of the fallopian tubes, and that effectively sterilizes a patient. Like with a vasectomy, it's not good the day we do the procedure. It is effective for contraception once the tubes are completely sealed, which usually takes about 3 months. And so I think that we have gotten to the point where vasectomies and these transcervical sterilizations, their downtime's about identical. Their complication rate's very similar. Their effectiveness rate, extraordinarily similar. So I think we have started to make some improvements. Some of the risks of tubal ligation were always the risks of actually having surgery itself. So now that we've removed that anesthesia risk and so forth, it is much safer. And we do have to remind patients that we have about a 1 in 2 or 1 in 3 rate of uterine fibroids in our population. So that if somebody has is a female, she has some risk of having a uterine fibroid. But I think to say that the risks have been understated, it would be hard for me to address that as a general topic when it's a one-on-one conversation that you have with your own provider. And I wouldn't want to negate the patient's individual perception of how much information they got and whether that was the information that they needed, nor the providers on the provider side. There's so much available in writing about sterilization, contraception, contraception options. The CDC website has terrific amounts of information about the sterilizations that patients are offered. And if the caller would like to go to those websites, they can get all the detailed information.
Yeah. Is it still the case that sterilization is the most popular method of contraception? Look at just at numbers?
If we look at individuals over the age of 35, then between about 35 and 45/50, those years, those final years of contraception, about one-third of couples, either the male has been sterilized or the female has been sterilized or the female is infertile. So, yes, sterilization is the most common, but as we've gotten better understanding and acceptance and modernized the indications for intrauterine device use, I think that IUDs will probably take over sterilization.
Okay. Our guest in this hour of focus is Dr. Suzanne Troopman. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist, has practice in our area. Every other month on a Monday, she's on the program. We talk about women's health. It's an opportunity for you to ask questions. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have some others, so let's go there. Here we have another person who writes in that they had a complete hysterectomy 12 years ago. At age 30. In the last year or so, I was diagnosed with high blood pressure after a low lifetime of having low blood pressure and also pre-diabetes. My mom also was diagnosed with those things about 10 years after she hit menopause naturally at 50. Is this common? I was not allowed to go to hormone replacement therapy due to endometriosis and ovarian cancer, so I was au naturel during my menopause symptoms, but my mom took HRT throughout hers. I guess I'm just trying to understand what the effect of early menopause has on my health versus genetic predisposition and so forth. And she's interested in more information and if whether you can point her towards more information on that subject.
So I'm trying to do the math here, and the writer says that she experienced a hysterectomy at age 30, and her mom developed diabetes and elevated blood pressure 10 years postmenopause. So I'm trusting that this patient is still age 40. The average age of menopause has always been quoted to be about 51. A recent study showed that the age of menopause has decreased somewhat, so it's not unusual for women to enter menopause after about age 40. The patient is still within the time frame that she would be considered, if she was given hormone therapy, that she would be given actually what we used to always call, but we still do now prior to the time of natural menopause, call it hormone replacement therapy. So the caller may or may not, depending on working with her own physician, now that she has a propensity to diabetes and elevated blood pressure, she may not necessarily be a candidate for hormone therapy, but she might still. And on the other hand, hormone therapy after the time of menopause is called postmenopausal therapy. We do know that those people who have an earlier menopause will have a increased risk of low bone mass by the time they are older. We know that they will have an increased risk of heart disease because they tend to have a more abnormal lipid profile. But it usually other factors like the high blood pressure itself, the diabetes, one's weight, one's diet, some other things, the amount of exercise, the amount of atherosclerosis, not just necessarily your cholesterol, can all affect your rate of having heart disease more than probably the age of menopause. So it is true that as women age past menopause and lose their estrogen, they will have a increased risk of the conditions the patient's asking about, elevated blood pressure and diabetes. But again, there are other therapies rather than necessarily estrogen supplementation that would be used to ward off those conditions specifically. Having said all that, the caller said she was not allowed to take estrogen due to endometriosis, and I don't know her medical condition, but endometriosis is not an exclusion for taking hormone therapy after a hysterectomy. Modifications in timing and dose are often given, but endometriosis, I just want to make sure the average caller knows that that's not necessarily an exclusion. And also, in terms of ovarian cancer, most ovarian cancer has been linked more directly to the amount of time of ovulation and not so much to whether or not you've ever had estrogen supplementation. So I would need to know a little bit more about those conditions.
Okay. And one of the questions she's also wondering, given the fact that she has had a complete hysterectomy, she says she doesn't have a cervix or other female organ, so I'm guessing that means also her ovaries were removed. She wants to know, in terms of periodic exams, what she should have.
In terms of periodic exams, we still advocate that you visit a health provider like your gynecologist or your primary care physician on a regular basis to be evaluated for other conditions. But in terms of actual pap smears, if someone had never had an abnormal pap smear, the current guidelines are post-hysterectomy that you wouldn't need a actual pap smear.
Okay. Well, I'm hoping that that gets to the questions of the person who's listening. And I have, let me see, some others. We'll go to here. Can you talk about sex after menopause? The person is writing here, is it normal not to feel much of anything anymore? I'm not exactly sure what that means. I don't know if that means lack of interest and desire.
Sure. Around the time of menopause, when we study women, about 43%, and that was the biggest study, it was a funny number, 43%. So over 4 out of 10 patients will report sexual dysfunction after the time of menopause. In the largest study, which was actually out of Melbourne, Australia, that followed women out over the next almost full decade, they found that by that full decade having passed, that 43% blossomed up to about 85% of people reporting some degree of sexual dysfunction. A significant amount of the sexual dysfunction at the time of menopause is directly related to the vaginal tissues themselves, and the vaginal tissues thinning, not producing the amounts of fluid, probably some decrease in nerve endings so that actual numbers of orgasms and the type of orgasms do as well tend to go down because estrogen has traditionally been not only an extremely effective treatment, but the only treatment available. We're now continuing to do research in this area specifically, and actually one of the new SERMs, the selective estrogen receptor modulators, that's actually that some of our patients, hopefully somebody listening, might have been in a research study on a new drug called osbenmafine. And it is specifically a SERM that is not an estrogen, but that treats vaginal dryness. And so we do have hopes that there will be treatments that are not hormonal. But we've also discovered that extremely low doses of estrogen given over fairly short periods of time can reverse the effect of sexuality in decrease in menopause. And we have another study that probably won't be enrolling until February or March, so I wasn't really going to talk too much about it. But if somebody wants to shoot me an email and pop on a list, we'll call you when we're ready to go. But we'll be working with a new low dose of estrogen. But at any rate, we do say that her problem is common. There are effective treatments, and one thing that we've been encouraging patients to do is come and see their gynecologist and try to figure out, work together on what can be done, because there are some treatments.
Mm-hmm. Well, is it easy to separate out the difference between or those women who would say their desire for sex has declined and you know that that's related to hormones, and those women who would say that, well, maybe it wasn't so much that, but if having intercourse is painful, well, you're also not going to want to do it. So, and it might not be that you're not interested, but if it said so uncomfortable, you say, well, I'm not going to do this.
And overall desire disorders, we don't have any specific. There is no female Viagra. Viagra doesn't work in women very often. There are few specific indications for it, but we are madly searching the female Viagra. We've been in several of those research trials, so there is, again, some hope, and there are some medications that are effective for decreased desire, and sometimes hormone replacement therapy if you had a hysterectomy at a young age, or hormone therapy if you've crossed over into menopause and it's only a desire component, but I was going with she thought things weren't working.
Okay. Well, in any case, follow-ups are welcome. Calls are welcome. Our guest is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She's an obstetrician and gynecologist. She's on this program every other month on a Monday. We talk about women's health. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, since we've been talking so much here about hormone replacement, people, I'm sure they will cast their minds back to when maybe we first started talking about this and started talking about hormone replacement as a way to try to prevent osteoporosis and then the bone fractures. And it probably wasn't long after that that a number of other things got laid on top of that that were at least thought of as being potential benefits. But it seems, as I think about it, the thing we really started out with, the big thing, was to try to prevent osteoporosis.
Well, actually, probably it's more accurate to say that the first thing that people were preventing were hot flashes. But then
Okay.
Positive effects on bone health, rather as something that hormone therapy was being used for that was medically preventative and a medical condition, not so much a menopause thought of condition. Absolutely. Prevention of osteoporosis, prevention of actual fractures was talked about with our patients as a potential benefit from estrogen. And the Women's Health Initiative study that started producing information about long-term estrogen use started coming out with their data around 2000, and literally somewhere between a decade and 6 or 8 years ago, many, many women discontinued their hormone therapy because of the statistically increased risks that were associated with hormone therapy that were now perceived to be a little bit worse than some of the risks that we had laid out to begin with. And not only that, but many women entering menopause either never considered hormone therapy or wouldn't accept hormone therapy. So interestingly, a Kaiser study recently looked at a large, very good database of their patients, and they found that, sure enough, of patients who discontinued their hormone therapy, that an increased risk of actual hip fractures was seen by about over 50% greater increased risk of hip fractures in patients that had stopped their hormone therapy. Mm. Now, if a patient had stopped her hormone therapy and switched over to a medicine, a bisphosphonate like an Actonel or a Fosamax or Ativiva or Reclast or Beneva, then those effects were not as significant. So if she did something to protect her hips, she didn't put her hips newly at risk. But once you stop hormone therapy, the benefits that you're talking about that we used to focus so much on years ago of protection of your bone was real. and it does wear off, and that the increased hip fracture rate had an onset of about 2 to 3 years out.
Okay. I want to come back to that, but I have a caller here, and rather than make them wait, why don't we get right to them? And this is someone who's listening in Urbana, and it is line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I am calling because my daughter-in-law, who's 33, has been diagnosed with polycystic ovary syndrome, began with a very severe vitamin D deficiency, for which she was experiencing vertigo and dizziness and just feeling unwell. And I am wondering, other than metformin, she also is insulin resistant now. Is there any other treatment, and is there anyone in our community who specializes in polycystic ovary syndrome treatment?
Well, we know that somewhere between 6 and 10% of our population will be diagnosed with a polycystic ovarian condition. We used to call it a disease, polycystic ovarian disease, and now we prefer to use the term syndrome. When patients get into the full-blown stages, they might have actually diabetes and heart disease, be significantly overweight, and have problems with their menstrual cycle that also can lead to both irregular periods and infertility. And in fact, this group tends, in the full-blown syndrome, to have elevated male hormones, and that the elevated male hormones can translate into what we call hirsutism, or increased actual hair growth. The most minor cases, people live their whole lives and never know that they've ever been diagnosed, but perhaps, say, they're having an ultrasound for some other reason, non-specific abdominal pain, they may be seen to have the traditional features of polycystic ovary on their ovary and have literally no other signs or symptoms. So there's a huge spectrum. Because
can I interrupt you a second here? She has 30 follicles on one ovary and 16 on the other. Her testosterone levels are elevated. She has quit having periods since March, and she has insulin resistant syndrome. So she's pretty far along, and we're concerned about how we can treat her, or if we can find a specialist, someone who would be willing to think of other things besides metformin to use for her.
So we appreciate that your daughter's condition is severe. And what I was going to say is that all of us gynecologists see many, many people with polycystic ovarian condition. The local endocrinologists who specialize in endocrine treatment do also consult in cases of the more advanced cases. And we have medical centers that are within our sort of region in terms of Indianapolis and Springfield and St. Louis and Chicago if somebody has a condition that isn't treatable. It's possible that whoever is treating your daughter feels that metformin is the ideal treatment. Most patients also are considered for anti-androgen therapy, as well as ovulation suppression therapy, and those other therapies are actually very commonly prescribed. Whenever I do second opinions on patients, I see many physicians have utilized those other methods. So I would feel like there are many other alternatives other than metformin, and that our local gynecologists do a good job in general.
Can you give me a name of a local endocrinologist?
Carl, if you call the PAL line at Carl, they can put you in touch with who is the endocrinologist at Carl and at Christie. We have in our community, I'm not part of Christie, but they have endocrinologists as well. And so both are possible for consultation. I think for those of us that are board certified in obstetrics and gynecology, we probably treat the most patients. Those of us that have been around the longest probably have treated the most patients. But there absolutely are many different treatments that we do utilize. And it depends on, for other callers listening, depends on what your therapy is. What you're interested in, once you get your anti-androgen therapy under control, and for many people it can be something as common as spironolactone, but there are other anti-androgens that we do use. But if your anti-androgen therapy isn't resolving hirsutism, those of us like myself that do laser hair reduction, we can utilize therapies like that to treat that aspect of the condition. So there are some places that can probably treat the patient a little bit more globally, and in other cases patients may need to kind of pick and choose and get sure. various aspects of their care. So many gynecologists don't do as much primary care to, say, manage a pre-diabetic.
Had you been aware of the connection as a causative agent between severe vitamin D deficiency as a trigger for polycystic ovary syndrome?
Well, a lot of the information coming out on vitamin D has been somewhat controversial. Mm-hmm. In a recent National Institute of Medicine report, they feel like many of the things we're attributing to vitamin D were based on preliminary studies that may not have separated out other factors adequately, and that some of the conditions that we have been treating, talking about relative to vitamin D, such as fatigue and some of the other things, may in fact not be due to that. And you can't get experts to even agree on what vitamin D deficiency is. We don't all agree on the same number that we would like to see in a patient's blood level. So when you say severe deficiency, you got to figure out what normal is before you can
sure.
move on to severe. So that's kind of hampered things.
Mm-hmm. And would you suggest treating this from a metabolic syndrome aspect in terms of diet and that sort of thing to reverse the insulin resistance syndrome?
Weight reduction cures almost all evils. With the data on polycystic ovarian syndrome, we know that even small amounts of weight reduction in the ranges of 5 pounds, 10 pounds, 20 pounds, depending on where you're starting, actually will start to improve all parameters of the condition. And so it's always the chicken or the egg. There are some physicians that feel very strongly that it was a lot of weight gain that triggered some patient. I'm taking it that the patient we're speaking about has weight to lose, or you wouldn't have asked. But
yes, she gained it during this period of time.
And it may very well be that she had a more mild condition, and with weight gain, that condition blossomed in a sense and came to medical attention. Whereas weight loss will improve things, but it's not the only strategy. And it's okay. not necessarily going to reverse it enough to prevent the medical complications that the hormone levels produce.
Oh, thank you so much for answering all these questions. I so appreciate it. Mm. I actually saw you many years ago.
Well, thank you for the
call. Well, I try to look the same, so come on back now.
We're talking this morning in this hour of Focus with Dr. Suzanne Troopen. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. Every other month, she's here to talk about women's health. We'll talk some more in just a moment. We'll take a short break first. This is Focus.
This is Terry Gross. Often when I'm interviewing people on Fresh Air, they give me a different way of looking at the world.
We all thought our bike was cold in the rain, that our fish was lonely in a fishbowl, that a leaf would be afraid of heights when it fell. It's just the way we looked at things.
Join us for new ways of looking at things on Fresh Air.
Monday through Friday at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support comes from The Music Shop, celebrating 50 years of service to music education. The Music Shop serves over 200 school music programs with band and orchestra instruments, a large sheet music department, and thousands of accessories at 27 East Market View Drive in Market View Plaza, Champaign, or at themusicshop.com.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you here. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, 10 different topics every week. I always welcome your questions, comments. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock show, we'll talk with Daniel Solove. He's professor of law at George Washington University Law School. We'll talk about his book, Nothing to Hide, The False Trade-Off Between Privacy and Security. And then we'll have another visit with Patrick Smith. He's been on the program before. He's a commercial airline pilot, also writes an air travel column for Salon.com and has his own website, which is AskThePilot.com. So we'll talk a little bit about air travel, the airline business, and you can get the perspective of somebody who flies professionally as a pilot. That's tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings, 10 to noon, 10 different topics for you every week. We always welcome your questions and comments. You can go to our website, check on the schedule, listen to past programs. That's WILL.illinois.edu. This morning, our guest is Dr. Suzanne Truppin. She's an obstetrician and gynecologist. She's on the program every other month, always on a Monday. We talk about women's health, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The email is will-talk@illinois.edu. I wanted to go back just for a second to ask a question about long-term use of bisphosphonates. And there seems to be some question about are there potential problems, or is there some point at which you'd say there really isn't a benefit anymore?
See, that's why we have this discussion, because you use the word long and you don't say 1 year,
what do you
5 years,
mean?
10
oh, okay.
years,
okay.
et cetera. And that's, I think, one of the problems. So first of all, we always have to establish on an ongoing basis, is your therapy working for you? So patients who are losing bone, having fractures, having increased rate of bone turnover markers in their urine, their therapy may not be working. And so, of course, that patient should be a candidate for some other type of therapy going forward in time. We also have to look at the two competing interests of the population at large and the patient at small, you know, mm-hmm. So that's where some of these guidelines start to conflict. We do know that a healthy bone has to turn over time, and that a very long acting bisphosphonate, such as the molecule that's in Fosamax, may over 5, 10, 15 years slow that bone turnover down so much that a medication holiday to allow that bone to wake up may be more healthy. So what we have discovered now that we've had these medicines available over a long period of time is that some patients will get beyond the help of prevention of hip fractures, wrist fractures, spine fractures, and get to the point where all of their bone mass has now slowed down so much that they're at risk for what we call atypical fractures, or fractures in other parts of our body due to the bone being somewhat, some people use the term frozen, but just not turning over, not as dynamic. Because if you think about it like a stick, if you had a little twig that you were trying to break, and if it was just off a very new growth, you can kind of bend it and bend it and bend it. It doesn't break. But if it's very dry and it's been laying on the ground and it's completely devoid of water, and you just snap it. And our bones, it's the same way. So it's not only the thickness of our bones that makes our bones healthy, but it's how that thickness is structured and how flexible that bone is to some extent. So when you stay on these medicines too long, perhaps you lose some of those actual properties that make your bone healthy. So that there have been some recent reports of atypical fractures in the femur or the thigh bone, and we haven't seen a lot of these fractures. People get these fractures who have never taken a single pill for bone therapy. And so what we're looking at is whether patients, once they've had 5 years, once they've had 10 years, particularly with a molecule that's still in their system and in their bones, do they now need a break, or perhaps maybe not only a break, but never going back on this therapy? And it is a question that experts haven't completely resolved. But for most patients, somewhere after 5 years and 10 years, they should sit down with the provider that's writing the prescription and figure out if they do need a medication holiday. And we need to look at what their levels of vitamin D are. What is your level of activity? How is your balance now? What's happened in your family history that may change our thinking? Did your mom break her hip since we've last put you on the medicine? We also will look at factors in terms of the patient herself. You fell down. Did you break your hip when you fell down? You had a bad fall and nothing happened. That's a good sign. So there are a number of factors that we actually look at before we actually offer patients these medication holidays. And I think as we move to some of the shorter acting, so more prescriptions being written for medicines like the Actonel and the Actaliva, which have a faster turnover, it may be that over time, that's going to be a better strategy. So to answer your question of atypical fractures, are they real? We think they're real. Are they at risk once you've been on long-term therapy? We think so. Have we defined exactly what long-term therapy is? Nope. And have we defined exactly who should be taken off when? No.
Okay.
But we have some hints.
All right. We're coming up. We have about 10, 12 minutes left here with Dr. Troopen. I have another email here, and you'll have to forgive me on my pronunciation because I'm not familiar with this. We have someone who's interested in having you talk about colpoclesis.
Okay.
Wants to know, is there anyone in the area who has done it frequently? The person writes, it's been the only option given to me because she has a prolapse and rectocele, as says, however, she is healthy and active.
It's a sewing down of the vagina.
Okay.
The most commonly performed operation is called a Lafort operation. I know it's not done very often because when I do one, usually the nurses have never seen it done. So I can't really exactly speak for other surgeons, but it rarely has an indication, or it rarely has a patient that really qualifies for it. If you want to be sexually active, this is not an operation for you. You won't have a vagina anymore. So I'm not sure what they mean by the word active. If you want to do jumping jacks and exercise and do your gardening, but sexual intercourse is not on your list of what it takes to be active, then it may very well be. It's a very safe operation. It's been done for decades and decades. It can be done relatively quickly. It can be done under a spinal anesthesia. And for patients who don't tolerate other types of operations, it can be hugely successful. It is the type of operation that allows you to correct these severe prolapses without the meshes that have come under some controversy as well. But actually, mesh operations are nicely designed to correct this kind of procedure and actually preserve a very functioning vagina as well. There are some more complicated gynecologic procedures that are designed to essentially tack the top part of the vagina up high, even to the lower part of the back portion of your pelvis called the sacrum. And there are a few gynecologists in town that I'm aware of that do those operations. Gynecologic oncologists sometimes do those operations. And I know that Carl has newly hired a gynecologic oncologist. It's not necessarily new. He and I were residents together. But I think that I would assume that he does those kinds of procedures as well, but he's so new, I haven't really talked to him about everything that he's doing. But I think that if somebody was being offered a gynecologic procedure and they had questions, get a second opinion. It's an excellent way to go.
All right. Well, and on to back to the phones here. Champagne is the caller here. Line number one.
Hi, good morning.
Yes.
Back to the bone problems. What do you think of Atelvia?
So that medication is a reformulation of the medicine Actonel or ricindrenate, a type of bisphosphonate. And I was actually in one of the research studies, and I do speak for them, so somewhat of a disclaimer. But the nice thing about this medicine is that it provides you with the medicine that Actonel that we know has positive spine benefit, has hip fracture protection, and also the biggest benefit is you can take it with food because it's been reformulated such that it releases in the intestine, so it passes down, and the meal that you take it in with does not disrupt its uptake into the into your bloodstream. Bisphosphonates are very poorly absorbed medicines. We only get about 1% of the medicine into our bloodstream. So if you disregard the instructions that your provider has given you for your bisphosphate intake, you're not getting medicine in, because if anything disrupts that 1% getting in, you're basically getting no medicine in your bloodstream whatsoever. So the fact that you can actually take it with food and not have to so precisely time when you have a meal after bisphosphonate intake has been a big benefit.
And what about it's compared to the other bisphosphonates? What about the risk of acid reflux?
So in the studies, they even had patients that had GERD or various acid reflux conditions that were actually placed on the medicine, and they had no worsening of their condition. For patients who have significant gastric or reflux problems, they're a better candidate if bisphosphonate is the right medicine and you have a severe condition or you've tried the alternatives, then you're really a better candidate for a medicine like zoledronic acid, brand name which is reclassed, which you get intravenously, so you bypass the gut whatsoever. You get one dose. It's effective for at least a one-year treatment, but in some studies, actually, bone mass was preserved for bone turnover, was held low for into year two and into year three. So it's a terrifically good medicine and a great alternative for people who can't take things orally.
Mm-hmm. That must be a very expensive treatment.
We find that most plans will cover these therapies very effectively. Cash treatment for the year, I believe that they're all very similar. Whether you pay over 12 months or you pay in one fell swoop, I think they're priced in a very similar range. But I know my nurses probably know that range. If I had to guess, I would say it's in the $1,000 to $1,500 if you had to pay cash. I don't think very many patients are paying anywhere as close to that. It's usually on their copay.
Okay, thank you.
No, thank you. We have had a couple of questions here that somehow touch one way or another on nutrition, and I think probably there is a great deal of interest in people saying, are there some things that I can do diet-wise or supplement-wise in terms of eating particular things or taking particular vitamins? You know, they want to know, are there some things that I can do to increase my chances of being healthy or reduce my chances of getting particular kind of diseases? I think one of the things that was on your list that we might talk about was connections between diet and ovarian cancer. Is there something that you can say that if by doing certain kinds of things in your diet, you could actually reduce your risk of ovarian cancer?
Well, it's pretty interesting, but there are some new studies that suggest that if we increase the amount of soy in our diet, that we will have a lower risk of ovarian cancer. The challenge is to increase the amount of soy that you take in enough. When we compare an American diet with a soy latte to, say, an Asian diet, it's not equivalent. An Asian diet has a tremendous amount of soy. They're eating soy beans as snacks and soy as part of their vegetable, and soy in miso soups, and they're adding tofu into lots of different aspects and cooking with soy flour. So you start getting up into those higher levels of soy are probably the protective levels. And you have to work at it a little bit and sit down, possibly even with a nutritionist or somebody that can guide you into how to switch your type of cooking and diet over. There are tremendous numbers of resources on these things available on the internet.
Yeah. Is really, though, do you think that your average American would be able to, interested in, motivated enough to change their diet that much so that they'd get enough soy so it would make any difference?
Are you saying change is hard?
Yes. I'm saying change is hard.
Change is hard. And there's also some controversial, but there is evidence out there that changing at 50 is no good. You got to change at 5. We got to change our kids' diets first. And we introduced soy formulas. And, you know, we want people to breastfeed as long as possible. But eventually, some do get some formula. We introduced soy formula a long time ago. But even babies fed soy formula probably left their soy diet and never looked back. Mm. And maybe not so much at age 5, but definitely as we progress through puberty, does it take that to really see the reduction in some of these cancers and metabolic conditions? So you're right, and that makes change less hard because it occurs slowly over time.
Okay. How about vitamins in pregnancy?
So a new study done by the National Birth Defects Prevention Group has shown that just taking vitamins doesn't get as healthy of a baby as having a good diet. In fact, when they tried to do the statistics and looked at just moms using folate supplementation, if their diet was no good, they still had an increased rate of birth defects, whereas the moms that had a good diet anyway had benefit from extra folic acid supplementation. And again, like so many studies, when the news first hits, we start thinking about, okay, what can explain this, and how does this apply to all of our patients? Because we have so much more supplementation in our food than we used to have years ago. And we have come to realize that it's not just folic acid that prevents birth defects. It's having good nutrition in all the vitamin areas. And so it's pretty interesting. So when you pre-pregnancy plan, you can't just add a vitamin pill. You have to have that overall good nutrition.
Well, see, sadly enough, that's, I think, probably any nutritionist will say to you, we would like you to get your vitamins by eating a good diet rather than taking the magic pill. That's not going to, you know, if that's the only way, okay, take a vitamin supplement, can't hurt. But really what we'd like you to do is eat healthy, get your vitamins like that.
And knowing change is hard, I sort of split the difference with my patients, and I tell them I would like to see you get your good nutrition out of your diet, but particularly on days where you actually are watching your calorie intake and you know your nutrient intake is going to go down, or on days that for whatever reason your nutrient intake was on the low side. Those are good days for your vitamins. May not be as the take your pill every day approach. We're meeting halfway.
We'll have to leave it at that. Our guest is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She's an obstetrician and gynecologist. Her practice is Women's Health Practice in Champaign. She's here every other month, always on a Monday. And thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.